Growing up in Sunday school, I was taught from the Bible, those who bless Israel will be blessed, and those who curse Israel will be cursed. And from my perspective, I want to be on the blessing side of things.
Of the those who bless the government of Israel?
Those who bless Israel is what it says. It doesn't say the government of, it says the nation of Israel.
Hi, my name is David, and I'm apparently the King of Israel. I declare that if you don't like, subscribe, and comment on this podcast, you are anti-Semitic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to David's Kingdom of Human Reaction. We are glad to be here with you once again.
Finally, we're down with the monarchies here. I've been trying to push this. for months.
Well, in the wake of the no kings thing, we had to go pro-king, right?
Yeah, right.
Just to balance it out a little. Yeah.
Curtis Yarvin's ghost haunting the room.
No one's going to get that but us. Oh. And our SCIF members.
Ghost?
Get that.
He's still alive.
I know, but it's like he's not here, but like his spirit is, you know?
Yes.
It's a very Hegelian interpretation.
Ooh.
Curtis Yarvin is with us all.
All right. We are just deep into nerd territory, and we're 15 seconds into the show.
Already there.
Everybody, thank you so much for joining us. We are glad to have you, as David so aptly professed from the throne. Please do like, comment, subscribe, and follow. If you're on Apple Podcasts, actually, I have a request for Apple Podcast listeners. We need more reviews on Apple Podcasts, so please give us 5 stars, leave us a comment if you like the show. All right, let's get into things.
Yeah, and also comment on the video on whichever platform you're on. YouTube especially. We want to put the YouTube numbers up.
Yeah, the algo loves the comments, man.
Yeah.
It really makes a difference.
That is actually the biggest thing for YouTube, I think, is comments. Mm.
I think
comments.
So Startify, Riot, just say something in there to get other people pissed off.
Okay.
Tell us we're idiots. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I'm down. Just call me ugly. Call me an idiot. I'll take it.
I'll be in the comments doing that like right now.
Joe was just doing it before the show.
I think we want to know from you is, do you think David would be better as the head of Israel than Bibi?
I did see, who was it? I saw a tweet from somebody saying, like, so if people name their kid Jesus, like, is he just like the Lord? Like, is that new kid the Lord and Savior just because his name is Jesus?
Right? It's a lot of Lord and Saviors in Mexico.
There's a lot of Jesuses.
Jesus.
Yep. Jesus delivered my DoorDash the other night, and I was like, this is a sign.
Jesus is back.
No, actually, it said, like, Jesus is arriving with your meal, and I was like, what?
Give us this day our daily bread.
Jesus is delivering your Panera today.
Speaking of, in that line, the meme that we pulled here is we got the classic Drake meme of they're like, Pope Leo? Nah. Bibi?
Yeah. Yeah. Dispensationals be like. And so for those who don't know, who don't follow the Christian dialogue around this issue, dispensationalists are pretty much the people who interpret the Bible along the way Ted Cruz did there up front. So let's dive into the Tucker Cruz interview, because that was interesting amongst anything, because it was probably the closest we've gotten to really discussing dispensationalism in public in that way. And I thought that was interesting. But I feel like the fundamental MAGA sentiment was best articulated. Probably it's better than it's ever been articulated in that interview with this first clip.
Like, no, but I was accused of being, I think it's weird that you went to a Russian grocery store and said it was prosperous. No, my point is.
It looked like a commercial. It looked like a commercial. Isn't this wonderful?
No, it was an argument against the efficacy of sanctions. Sanctions against Russia, which you casually and enthusiastically imposed, scoring a little moral victory every time, had no material effect that helped the United States. Russia is backstopped by China. And I recommend that you go there and see it. It is way nicer than Washington, D.C. Way nicer. To me, that's a tragedy. I was horrified and angry at my leaders, including you. It's like, I want to live in a country that's nice, with low food costs and no homeless people.
All right.
I don't understand why that's too much to ask.
So do
I. Instead, I get worse with Iran. No, I just want lower food costs. How's that?
It's a weird argument that you do often, which is, listen, things are crappy in America. Liberals have done bad things to America, so we shouldn't worry about any enemies around the world.
Republican senators, Republicans don't care about us. They're focused on other countries.
But you wrote that.
And our country is dying, and you don't care because you're focused on Iran or Putin.
So you believe that I don't care about America. I guess you believe Donald Trump doesn't either. Like, nobody cares.
I believe that your focus is way too on other countries.
It's way too focused outward. The money that you send abroad could be used here and should be.
What money that I send abroad, by the way, I emphatically agree with.
How much did you send to Ukraine? You don't even know.
Classic Tucker laugh.
Yeah.
How much money did he send to Ukraine?
A lot. I mean, I think that sentiment of it doesn't really matter how much per se, even. It's really about the priorities.
Right.
And I don't want to note this, especially in the context of the war in Iran. The height of the social conservative movement was George Bush, right? I mean, Reagan didn't really do anything for them. George H.W. Bush kind of failed for them. They were in the dark woods of Bill Clinton's regime for 1990s social conservatism. And then George Bush was seen as like, they're the ones who's actually going to get this all across the line. They finally have someone who's like this Bible-believing Christian person who ran with a humble foreign policy, who's going to focus domestically. And then 9/11 happens, and everything becomes about that for six more years.
Yeah,
after the war in Iraq, even more so. So, like, wars of choice do have trade-offs domestically, and it's not just infrastructure spending. It's also our tax rate. It's everything else that goes into that. I mean, I don't even think Tucker's saying, I don't want Build Back Better that actually works, you know, that actually puts shovels in the ground. He's like, keep more money in localities and states where people can solve their infrastructure problems.
Yeah.
You know, because there is a trade-off between federal taxes and state and local taxes. Mm-hmm. People only have so much money to give a government.
Right.
We're debating that right now with the big, beautiful bill with salt tax increase and whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So, like, that sentiment, I think, is the root. It's like the underlying moral moment that MAGA is trying to reconcile with, the inner contradiction.
Do you perceive someone who's leading right now in that argument, in that tug of war between these two sides?
Oh, that's a great question. I feel like that is, at least for the conservative side of MAGA, right? Because MAGA is a coalition of lots of disaffected liberals and libertarians and, you know, the old school conservatives who have been around since the 1990s trying to get something had to happen for them. And they're like, we have this opportunity. And it felt like for 100 days there, like this was going to be the thing that happened. We're going to get deregulation. We're going to get a tax cut. We're going to get spending cuts. We're going to get these things with Doge and all this kind of hope and ambition. And now it's like, nope, war with Iran is what's more important.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think for the conservatives in there, that should be the number one thing they're thinking about. I'm not sure. And I think if you look at maybe, what was the guy, Walsh from Daily Wire?
Matt Walsh.
That's kind of, I think, his underlying sentiment. I mean, I don't think he's articulated as well as Carlson has. But man, if I was him, that's what I'd be concerned about.
For sure.
I also want to highlight some of the points that Tucker made on the Russia stuff, because I remember back in the day when he did the Russia video where he's like going through the grocery store and everybody's like, how dare you? And one of the things that I did highlight there was particularly the that Russia's not as worse off as we in the West have been kind of thinking they are. Did you guys see the Putin comments on the peace talks recently?
No.
So the next round of peace talks with Putin and Zelensky are happening on Sunday. And I found it very interesting for him to, because he has a lot of leverage in this right now. I found it very interesting to the point where he was like, he kind of looked at the everything on the table right now. And he's looking at it and he's like, you know what? The question is, who's going to be signing the other side of the deal? Zelensky's not legitimate. His government's not legitimate. His masters are the ones that I should be negotiating with.
Ooh.
And then he goes on to kind of articulate who those masters are, where he's like, I see the German tanks. I know the German satellite intelligence is happening. There's no way Zelensky could be doing it without those satellite intelligence right now. It's also particularly interesting on the Iran conflict right now, as we're seeing there was a transponder that accidentally flipped on a German plane on a refueling jet over Jordan, which is kind of interesting. So it's kind of interesting right now where I'm seeing a lot of people should be paying a lot more attention to Russia in this moment in time right now, mm-hmm. with everything that's going on, because it's very curious how all of a sudden, like, Putin stalled out the negotiations there for a little bit. And now he's like hyper focused on, okay, now it's the time for the deal. And it seems like everything's coalescing and aligning for July for everything to be kind of coming together right now.
In terms of peace deals to occur.
Peace deals. Yeah. Like there's a new 2-week ultimatum that's gone on from Trump to Iran. Like we're seeing things come together right here. And it's just like, everybody's focused on Iran right now, but it's like, the Russia-Ukraine thing is also very important right now. And like, Russia's not bad off right now. Russia's right. Doing okay. And people need to realize that.
They're gaining ground pretty substantially. The you know, since the failed spring of summer offensive of two, was that last year or the year before?
It's like a flip switched all of a sudden.
Yeah. And they're gaining more ground, and it's not, you know, obviously the deeper rocket attacks aren't as frequent, but we do have things like Operation Spiderweb and things like that that happened the week before. You know, I think largely Russia and Iran, that dynamic is very important, right? I mean, they are long-term allies. They have been since the Russia or the Iran-Iraq war. When Russia was cut out of Europe in the 90s, 2000s, that forced them into the hands of China and the other non-U.S. client states, mm-hmm. like Iran. So the two major blocks, you know, is the Western world versus Iran, Russia, and China. And North Korea. They're kind of hanging out there, too.
We're here, too, guys.
Yeah. It's also worth noting on the Russia stuff, too, is that at the G7 summit in Canada last week, that Trump left early on because of the Iran stuff, the very first thing out of Trump's mouth was, why isn't Putin here? Why aren't we the G8? Obama and Trudeau pushed everyone to vote Putin out. None of this would be happening right now if Putin was here.
Interesting.
And it's just... people should have that in their framework as they're thinking about all these things right now.
Right. You wonder. I mean, I don't think we wonder on this show. Our listeners probably don't wonder, but it does raise the question of like, well, what were they trying to do by kicking Putin out? If your interest was global harmony and peace, you wouldn't do that because you'd come to the table and you'd negotiate and you would have your counterparties all involved here. Instead, you know, they kind of create this othering moment where they remove Russia from the conversation, and then it becomes much more easy to demonize and vilify and argue for.
And that's why the whole Tucker trip over was so interesting. And like, I don't think people really grasped why that was important, was because we have been living in the dark for a long time, ever since Ukraine happened, and actually before Ukraine happened, of mm-hmm. this like evil man, Putin, Russia, the Russia hoax, all that stuff mm-hmm. going on. Right. And, yeah,
and that propaganda runs deep.
And it's like an embodiment of a dynamic, right? You have the hegemony first. Hegemony is most important question of the Republicans always seem to be more interested about what's going on in other countries than they are here. Mm-hmm. As it's running up against the shoals of what does America first mean?
Right.
Right. And we covered earlier this week about, you know, Trump saying, I determine what it means, you know, and, you know, the commentariat around him saying, well, wait a minute, that means a campaign promise and it feels like you're not fulfilling them. Like, our role is to reinforce you to do your campaign promises. So that dynamic, that discussion is embodied in this, right? And that's why Trudeau and Obama kicked him out of the G7, the hegemony, right? It's about creating that they want to create Russia into another state that is deferring to American foreign policy and corporate interests. That model of the hegemony is this thing that has its own, you know, metaphorical will and incentive structure, is Trump is pulling back there in Russia and maybe trying to advance it in Iran.
Hmm.
Might be the model you can think of to kind of understand this in the biggest picture.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Sure. It goes into my Europe thesis, too, of the separation between, like, this has always been the British Empire's goal, was to separate the United States and Russia. That was always a concern for them.
Why?
Was because those two powers surrounding Europe would be very disastrous for the Europeans. And if those guys are communicating, especially when you have, like America, and like a lot, there's the Alaska connection, like they're neighbors actually.
Mm-hmm.
When people are, so you have Europe that's constantly, you have the remnants of the British Empire that has established all of, like, their widespread intelligence network is still sitting there because, like, the British Empire is still like around in a sense, like the European Union and the British, like in the British financial elite. And they've placed all of their, their influence within all these different factions at the places that the British Empire had touched. You have like the Koreans, North South Korea, you have everything going on in South Africa, you have Israel, Iran, you have United States, Canada. Like they still have that widespread in India, Pakistan, mm-hmm. like you still have that widespread influence that exists there. And they're pulling triggers. Like everybody wants to hyper fixate on just United States, Russia, China, but like Europe itself is still also a major player in this, and they have massive influence games. Mm-hmm. Like the Likud party is like an extension of Davos in a lot of ways, right? So like these are the games, like there's different factions. You have to look at the factions at play in all of these different regions to really get a clearer picture of what's going on.
Yeah. Keep in mind that the reason why we kicked Mossadegh out and put in the Shah in the 1950s was because BP oil was going to lose their exclusive rights to all of that. It's like, and it's crazy when you think of the numbers too. It was the Iran would get like 15% of the oil value that exported out of Iran. That was the deal they made with the government. And then when Mossadegh is like, oh, well, I want to modernize, I want to become like a first world country. This deal is exploitative. We're going to nationalize it because you won't accept any other deal. And then next thing you know,
he's out,
and we have Operation Ajax, right?
Yeah,
Ajax, to overthrow him, and that's MI6 with the CIA. The model then becomes: well, is this just a continuation? This is everything is in that backdrop. Everything here, if you're looking at the European connections, they stand to benefit tremendously from a puppet state in Iran, or a democratic republic in Iran, or a monarchy, like any other state they stand to benefit from, because these guys are the descendants of the people who overthrew their puppet regime, the Shah.
France gets 28% of Iran's oil exports, right?
Yeah.
Like, then it's like Macron's freaking out right now.
Right.
He has been freaking out since the G7. Like he's been freaking out this whole time. It's very obvious.
Can you dive into that? That's currently they get 28%.
Yeah, I my understanding is I believe how it works is that they work through China by proxy. China gets discounted oil from Iran, and like 90% of it's something like 90% of Iran's oil goes to China, and then China then dishes it out to people. Mm-hmm. And it's like North Korea, France, Venezuela, a bunch of like all the worst places. Venezuela, France, and North Korea.
That is such a weird list when you think about it. Why does Venezuela import oil?
Yeah, good question.
I don't know.
They're huge.
I think I saw Venezuela on the list. Don't hold me to that. I'm more interested in the France connection.
It could be a financial type too. It could. I mean, they have oil infrastructure. So
I know there's South American countries that get Iranian.
So break down for us the consequence of the shakeup in Iran and what that means for French oil imports from there. Why are they freaking out?
Instable markets. Macron's freaking out.
Yeah.
So if there's conflict in Iran, then you know there's uncertainty with regard to the supply of oil. Prices go up. France's economy relies on that.
Also the aftermath. Well, and Macron seems to have like big ambitions right now. Like he seems to be kind of going to war in a sense, like diplomatically with the UK, Germany, and Italy too. Like I think there's a lot of tension that's going on there. I don't know it fully, like I don't have a full understanding of it, but like Macron is like amping up their own military side of things. Like they're going into much more mass production on stuff on that side. So like there's something happening there that I don't fully understand. Like Macron's making plays, him and his tranny wife, they're like making plays right now. And I don't
he found out the world knows he's married to a dude and didn't care. So he's like, it's time to take over the world.
It's time to take over.
This is it. At least part of it too, Joe, is like the Strait of Hormuz is a really important play here. There's a tremendous amount of economic activity that goes through there.
Yeah.
Iran has been able to block it before. If U.S. Iran go to if there's a direct conflict between the two countries, Strait of Hormuz will be a variable in that. A disruption of that oil supply will change national markets and natural gas supply. There's a huge natural gas deposit there that Qatar and Iran use.
The blocking of everything in that area is like that's one of the reasons why Qatar was spending all this money in America was to influence Donald Trump 1.0 on getting Saudi Arabia and Egypt and a bunch of those different countries to back off on their blockades on Qatar, right? So like that region itself, like there's a reason why we fought a Gulf War, right? like it's a very important region.
Wouldn't the interruption of trade in the Strait of Hormuz affect all of Europe, not just France? Why is France so particularly concerned?
Kyle hates France.
Well, they get, I mean, it's just in particular, France is the one getting all the oil from Iran. It's not the, like, which then by proxy probably helps Europe as a whole and things like that. But like France has long, has for a long time had a strange relationship with Iran. Like they were involved. I'm blanking on the history here. Back during the Jimmy Carter hostage situation, they had a big, they had like this animosity with America, and they were involved on the Iranian side on that in some way. I can't remember the history. Like there's a history there that people could look into.
We may have to dig into
which
that.
Which is, yeah.
So the overall foreign policy vibe, I think, is the other main thread of three that was articulated here.
Yeah.
How is your foreign policy different from Jimmy Carter's? Seriously, please.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Jimmy Carter? So what century is this? I am the product of the last 25 years, watching carefully, being involved in the periphery, and I see an unending string of foreign policy disasters that have impoverished and hurt our country.
Unending string.
Unending string. They would include Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and our inability to stop the Houthis, by the way, in Yemen, which exposes us as weak, and I grieve over that. So these are failures. You help preside over some of them. As a member of the Senate,
what failures, foreign policy failures, have I presided over?
Well, we were unable to beat Russia in the war that you supported against Russia,
and that's the kind of interviews, the new media interviews that I really want to see.
Yeah,
right. That kind of that it's not. I mean, it's hostile, but it's not hostile. It's like this: I'm going to probe back, I'm going to push back when appropriate, whereas I'm connecting dots and helping people understand.
Right, and there obviously has been an unwillingness generally for the mainstream press to do that. At least, I mean, maybe not so much on the side of Republicans, but in this case, it's really interesting because you have two Republicans going head to head over a very contentious issue. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know who do you think came out on top in this debate, if you want to call it that?
It seems to me that Tucker did, in terms of articulating better the underlying sentiment of how people feel about the moment. Not knowing anything about foreign policy, just entering in and hearing that, you know, that we're going to war in Iran. Well, I mean, even Republicans, according to the polling, and we have polling from YouGov, Washington Post, Fox News, each of these, there's some real nasty figures here, right? I mean, for the pro-war side, right? I mean, at this time, Washington Post says, at this time, would you support or oppose a U.S. military launching airstrikes against Iran over its nuclear program? That's probably the best question I've found in a lot of these. A lot of the pro-war supporters are like, do you believe Iran should have a nuclear weapon? They're like, so, therefore, regime change war is perfectly supported by the American people.
Right.
45% oppose of the American public.
Oppose U.S. involvement over
30% are unsure, right? But then you get other ones like YouGov, which shows much nastier numbers for that. But even for Republicans, Republicans support at 47%, but you know, unsure at 24%, or at 29%, and 24% oppose. Right, so that's a little bit more negative than the YouGov polling, which suggests that even Republicans oppose. But you're still with, you know, the independents, 44%. You know, that's huge.
44% oppose intervention.
Yeah, and when you add the unsure to that, in which case this is. And typically in warfare polling, this is what happens. There's a big junk in the middle. They're unsure because they don't know much about the situation. They lag behind everyone else that isn't as politically interested. And then by, you know, with a little bit of time, they start seeing dead babies and they start seeing the cost and they start seeing, you know, people come home in body bags. That's going to move against.
Yeah.
Right. So.
And usually, yeah. I mean, is it more normal for, let's just use 9/11 as an example. Obviously, at that time, there was a tremendous amount of domestic support for that because of you know, the attack on our homeland. Mm-hmm. In this case, we're starting with a much higher negative number in terms of people who don't support intervention. So you only expect that to increase over time.
I think so. I mean, I don't see the propaganda working. I mean, the propaganda is running full time on Fox News. Like, we showed some of it on Tuesday. There is more there that we'll talk about today. There's such a different media environment right now, and especially when you look at young people and their support of Israel is so low, and we've covered that before, that the long-term generational phenomena is real, right? And so if Republicans really do want a new golden age where they're dominant in politics again,
they have to listen.
They have to do something different. I mean, I don't know if they can continue with it. And that's that moment that Tucker Carlson articulated so well. I've seen the unending chain of disasters. for my country as we've gotten systematically worse, even as we're the most prosperous country in the world, mm-hmm. right? I'm not trying to quote, I'm just trying to summarize. That idea, I think, is the sentiment that elected Donald Trump.
For sure.
Right. It wasn't, I don't, people didn't vote for Donald Trump because he wasn't, other than Ben Shapiro, didn't vote for Donald Trump if he did, and he probably didn't the first time, because he promised that Iran wouldn't get a nuclear weapon.
Right.
You know, even as that's been something he's been consistent about.
Right. I don't remember that being a primary campaign promise on the trail for Trump.
Yeah. Well, you're not an Israel firster.
I'm not.
Right. You heard among his many comments, most of the comments you agreed with, which was, you know, America first. And then, you know, people saying, now he's saying, well, he's not saying us go to war, but what people are hearing is us going to war on behalf of Israel is America first because Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. And people are contending with that contradiction.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the original thing that you said is the like Tucker versus Ted Cruz and how they came out of it. I think a lot of it's noise. I don't think it matters particularly either way on either side. I think that there's a lot of, I really support Tucker, or I really support Ted Cruz in this moment, but it's like nobody's minds are changed on where they were or anything like that.
Right.
I think that there is kind of a more middling position that you could be in on that too, as well, where I think like in general, I personally will lean a little bit more on Tucker's side on this, but and I think that Ted Cruz's arguments were kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways, but I don't think in particular it really means anything. And I think a lot of this polling data is also just noise in the moment, as oftentimes polling data is kind of just noise in the moment. And then things shift. It's kind of like markets where there's a lot of noise that happens and then everything evens itself out.
Yeah.
Especially in this moment, depending, I think a lot of things ride on how Trump navigates over the next few weeks. And as we go into July here, I think that American sentiment in general is very much, we don't want to see boots on the ground. And if Trump makes some sort of drastic action, like a bombing campaign, make it extremely quick. No nation building or whatever. I don't think people particularly care on regime change or not. I think regime change often has become a talking point to a lot of people. And what people actually are more concerned about is nation building mm-hmm. rather than the regime change itself. I think a lot of people, and I think that where we're probably going is I think that we're going to be seeing drastic changes to both the Israeli government and the Iranian government in the aftermath of this. The Israeli government's probably going to take a little bit longer, but Bibi's out before 2026. I doubt the Likud party is getting reelected back in. They're at 20% approval rating. I think that he is probably going to become a Churchill figure afterwards. Hmm. After this, he will be mythologized as the hero that took out the Iranian nuclear program, yada, yada, yada. And then he'll go retire in Greece with low approval ratings and he will be out for the rest of his political career. I think that's probably where it's going. Much like Churchill was. Like, that is the legacy of Churchill, is that he's deified in a lot of ways, but at the end of the day, he was voted out,
right?
Because people were kind of done with his shit.
Yeah, and well, and I mean, I think it bears mentioning, and we mentioned this on Tuesday, that, you know, the whole scandal that was going on around Bibi just prior to October 7th is still like lingering. It's still there. It's in the background. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's taking a back seat to the conflicts that have been going on, and for good reason. But those are still existing, and they'll have to be contended with at some point. You think?
I think the Likud party is a depreciating asset for Davos right now. For like the Davos European crowd. I think that's what's happening right now. I think that kind of the two major factions that are often prolonging this Israel-Iran tension are being drained out as we speak right now. And I think that's where like the quote unquote regime changes will happen. There are strong factions that are gaining more and more popularity within Iran, because there's like really four major factions in Iran. There are strong factions gaining more and more popularity that don't want to pursue the nuclear route. And that's probably where we're going. And they want to become more integrated into the international community. And that is the signal that's being made from people like Putin and MBS as well. Like the Gulf state leaders right now, they're signaling to Iran, do not take the bait. Do not attack America. Trump's not your real enemy here. Israel's not even necessarily your real enemy. Be patient. Like that's the signal that I'm getting from like people like MBS in this moment. Because like MBS, I think he's been making it clear that he wants to enforce and enhance relationships with Iran and allow Iran back into the fold of Middle Eastern politics.
So as far as the polling being noise, there's a sense in which that's true, in which case you will often see polls of the American public that say like, hey, I want a tax cut and without any benefits changing. similar to the foreign policy analogy is that is like, for example, in Fox News poll is they asked, do you think Iran poses a real national security threat to the United States? 73% said yes.
Wow, that's a lot.
And that's like completely ridiculous, right? They have no capability to actually harm the United States. Now right. Troops that we've literally lined their borders with, yes, but that's not the United States. Those are foreign troop deployments. Mm-hmm. But that's not distinguished here. Right. And I'm sure they're not even thinking of that. I mean, I assume the average American is thinking, like, oh, yeah, if they get a nuke, they'll just bomb Iowa.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes hand in hand with the rhetoric that you're hearing from guys like Ted Cruz or even Bibi. It said, you know, first it's Tel Aviv and then it's New York or it's San Francisco or whatever. And it's like, well, that's just lacking a lot of logistical context that, you know, if you know that stuff, you know that's just impossible.
Yeah, right. Well, they don't have intercontinental ballistic missiles, number one. Number two, they don't have the kind of targeting systems that allow for global targeting systems. And then third, and this is an interesting one that I thought was particularly, it's a very interesting argument that Scott Horton brought to the fore this week, which is the difference between plutonium and uranium. So plutonium is a derived from uranium. When you add neutrons to it, it takes a very specific kind of reactor to do that. Iran had that kind of reactor at the Arak facility at one point, AROK, A-R-A-K. That facility was filled with concrete after the signing of the JCPOA. So they had the ability to produce plutonium, which plutonium allows you to make much smaller missile and weapons that is much lighter that can cause an explosion. So one of the two bombs in Japan was, one was plutonium, one was uranium. The plutonium one was much smaller. The uranium one was much, much larger, much heavier. So even if you had that, they're not even really a threat to Israel right now if they can create, even if they do pursue a nuclear weapon, because as they, the uranium stockpile they have, it requires so much material to create the equivalent explosion to what we saw in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, that they don't have the weapons delivery system for that. You need a very large plane that's capable of carrying a lot. When Israel controls the skies, Israel has anti-aircraft. Even if it was before 2 weeks ago and they had done this secretly and then were flying it over there, that's near impossible. They have counter-aircraft, of course, fighter jets and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, even their regional missile systems aren't big enough to carry that load and deliver that missile. So is Iran a real threat is, you know, the further you go down the line, the weaker you see that argument is. The more the war propaganda looks like everything, right. The entire kabuki shadow theater.
Yeah. The Iran threat to America is the boogeyman propaganda to keep the proles moving forward in whatever direction they need to be moved forward. I think the real thing is about making the Middle East safe for business. At the end of the day, because Iran does have a terror network that causes problems in the Middle East. And for good, for better or worse, like there's, you know, everybody in this conflict is hero, villain, and victim in some regard, depending on your framework of all this. Like everybody wants to choose a good and evil of like this person, that person is like the hero, that person's the villain. It's much more complicated. No, there's no good guys in any of this. It's all a world of gray. It's all one big shit sandwich we all have to take a bite out of. So like and there were probably, it probably was kind of more so now's the time rather than they're literally 5 minutes away from the nuke. Like, I think that Iran does have nuclear ambitions and I think that they're working with North Korea on that stuff. Like North Korea has the warhead technology, like, and really Russia's the one in between stopping the non-proliferation from happening because they're deeply embedded in both the North Korean and the Iranian militaries. But I think what we're seeing right now is we've had this extremely tragic chapter of human history, which has been the Middle East. And we're watching kind of the myth making be crafted right now, which will be what allows us to turn the page and move into a different dynamic that ultimately allows both Trump and Putin to disentangle themselves militarily while allowing the Middle East to become open for business. And I think what's being offered on the table, and I'm seeing this from like the Gulf state leaders in this time in the types of rhetoric that they're making, is like Iran can be a part of this, but you have to make some concessions. Now, the libertarian take is going to be like, oh, it just means that Iran is like going to become a client state or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just like, yes and no, not really. I think it's more so that they can become their own, like, most of these countries, with the exception of Iran, actually, most of these countries are actually like very new countries. They're baby countries. They've only been here for 100 years. And they were kind of in these pathetic clan wars for so often. And now you have a lot of these countries who are wanting to come together. And we're seeing that with the Emirates. We're seeing that with Saudi Arabia. We're seeing that with Israel, in a sense. Israel has its own problems. But we're seeing this kind of like, no, we can build something here together. And some of the countries are getting their shit together. And I think those countries want Iran to get their shit together and kind of stop this terror network apparatus, stop this opposition. I actually think the Sunni Shia thing is kind of like irrelevant at this point. I think if that's still part of the framework, I think you're missing things, actually.
So are you saying that it's, you kind of suspect that regime change in Iran is a component of this broader deal that's being made, like that is a contingency?
I think it's
this deal?
A piece on the table. Like, it's an option on the table. It's a move that could be made, but it's a move that doesn't have to be made. And I don't think regime change itself is the end goal, but it's a vehicle to get to the end goal if necessary.
Interesting.
And that's why, like Trump is somebody that is like, all options are on the table. Mm-hmm. The negotiative route is one option. If that doesn't work, then it's the next option. If that doesn't work, it's the next option, right? Like, sure. That's kind of like, there's an end goal in place here. And I think the ultimate, if this chapter turns, now, plan could go wrong. Like, it could be embroiled in 20 more years of nightmare, and that's the libertarian concern, right? Like, that could be where this goes. But plan could go right, and I think the ultimately what ends up having is Putin is able to kind of disentangle himself from this mess, and also the United States is able to disentangle themselves from this mess. I think the people that don't want this to be disentangled from the mess is China and Europe. I think they want Russia and America to still be kind of in this shit sandwich.
Because if they're not, like you mentioned earlier, then there becomes a potential for a very powerful trade bloc to occur, and then that diminishes Europe's standing in the global economy.
And I think that's why we're seeing the Ukraine stuff happen at this time period. Like, it seems very clear to me Putin was stalling things out and waiting for time for more maximal leverage on this.
Interesting.
So the way I see the Abrahamic Accords in this variable that Kyle is articulating is the U.S. creating new client states out of states that were in a more neutral status. So when you look at who we're talking about, the UAE and Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco, each of those are relatively small countries that can be bought with economic agreements with the United States. The addition of the Saudis, for example, who have the biggest beef with Iran,
is contingent on like the Palestinian drama and the Iranian drama. Is their acceptance to it is contingent on that?
Yeah, yeah. Try not to quibble with the word drama. Like, I'm trying hard not to. That dynamic is, if applied to Iran, saying you have to eliminate Iran so that we can then join the Abrahamic Accords, and then you can solve, and we've accomplished the clean break, right? We no longer have to worry about the peace process with the Palestinians. They're just a blockage on the way to greater cooperation within, you know, the Middle East, and all of their concerns as a people, they don't really count because they're not the big money, right? I could totally see that as a legitimate strategy, but the way I interpret that is less so in that this is like this future that everyone wants, and more so this is the U.S. buying its way into the Middle East to control it further. And I think that has a lot of secondary order consequences that are not foreseeable or planable.
Mm-hmm.
And it ultimately, the idea that Iran will just regime change and become like these other countries, stable countries, is, I think, very low. It underweighs the ethnic diversity of Iran, the population of Iran. It overweighs, I think, what I think is likely the most likely play for regime change, which is the reinstall of the Shah, which I see as being built up everywhere, and have some more sections on that.
The media apparatus is really pushing for the Prince Reza reinstallation.
And so are the neocons, yeah. Right? Like the commentariat of the right-wing war party is definitely.
Quick, just synopsis of who that is.
Prince Reza is the son of the last Shah.
Gotcha. And he's the guy that we showed the video of last.
We got another video of it. And actually, if you don't mind, let's just to change it up a little bit. So the first dot under regime change programming, I think this articulation is probably the closest that I've seen, the best articulated and closest I've seen to what is likely, in my mind, the war party's vision of how they see this. And it's so close to being greeted as liberators, it is interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting moment.
For context,
are you talking about the Zero Hedge debate?
Yeah.
That's the that was the expectation of our entrance into Iraq.
Well, okay, if Israel undertakes a decapitation campaign, you've also got to reckon with the possibility that the Iranian people might undertake a decapitation campaign. You know that it was several years ago now, as a matter of fact, a full soccer stadium, looks like 50, 70,000 people in Iran was chanting, "Long live Reza Shah," who was the father of the deposed Shah of Iran. He was the Shah in the 1930s. And that kind of open defiance of the Islamic regime and disgust with the Islamic regime, also combined with the fact that, as I was trying to say before, that so many Iranians, where it's officially 90% Shiite Muslim and 95 to 99% Muslim in general, and actually only 40% of Iranians now identify as Muslims, is an indication of the deep disgust that the Iranian people themselves have for this regime. There was nothing like that in Iraq or Afghanistan. And both of those were wrongheaded and stupid from the beginning. This is a very different situation with a very different president. And the idea that he's just going to blunder into making...
You want to stop it?
Yeah, so I think that, like, oh, well, there's stadiums full of people for Reza Shah, which is the guy before the Shah that was installed. He's the guy who made the deal with BP. He's the guy who first introduced some democratic elements to Iranian society. A lot of the modernization through using the British Empire in the 1930s and the 1950s was largely him, right? So he's still remembered really well. The question is this other guy? And if you go to the X link below that, Kyle, that Fox News is calling, quote, "His Royal Highness."
Fox News is saying that?
Yeah.
About who?
If you bring it up, Kyle, the new guy, what's his name?
Pahlavi?
Yes, that's actually the wrong one. The His Royal Highness one is the one I liked. Or maybe I...
Oh, sorry. Wrong. I just pulled up the next excellent thing.
Yeah, but it is Pahlavi. It's Reza Pahlavi.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's Prince Reza.
Yeah, yeah. Today, His Royal Highness Reza Pahlavi, exiled Crown Prince of Iran. Yeah.
Okay. So what you're seeing here, what you're suggesting is that the propaganda apparatus is sort of starting to prop this guy up, sort of, you know, create some grandeur and mystique around him, and also say the people of Iran really support this guy coming in and sweeping to power and kind of prompting us to see this as, oh, this is the solution to this problem.
Right.
And it's a thing where, like, it's an area where I could see this going several different ways. Like, Prince Reza coming in, I think he does have a decent amount of support from what I've seen. But there are four real different factions in Iran right now. It's the theocracy, it's the IRGC, it's the civilian government, and the civilian military. Those are, like, the four main factions, and they all have sub-factions within them. Like, I could see another outcome here, and I think Trump is open to this outcome. Like, I don't think Trump really cares who winds up in leadership after this, as long as they're down for business. Like, but that's what I think Trump's real goal is here. And I could see a route, too, where it's just, like... one of the major factions is the IRGC, and there's kind of like sub factions within there. There's like the diplomatic reformists, there's the hardliners, et cetera. And like, I could see there being kind of a reformist IRGC member that ends up taking the lead in the future of this as well. You know, one guy, he probably wouldn't have been the leader, but it's kind of unfortunate because he was really the one that wanted to negotiate with the US a lot, is Ali Shamkhani. And he was part of the negotiation team, but unfortunately, he was a minority opinion when it came to accepting Trump's nuclear deal. So, like, it's one of those things where there are factions that want different things here. Like, it's not as simple as just, you know, like, I think people are kind of like black and whiting, like it's like this or that, and it's like it could play out a lot of different ways. And you know, there's another area here too where it could wind up being a civil war, and that's probably the worst case scenario in a lot of this. Is because then it becomes like all these other countries that are then influencing the civil war and how it plays out in the future. And that's probably that's actually probably the worst case scenario, especially from like a libertarian perspective of like, obviously the United States is probably going to get involved in that, right? Like
for sure.
That's where you end up seeing like troops on the ground doing this type of nation building stuff. And I think that's the worst case scenario.
Well, if nothing else, a lot of clandestine operations and money being funneled to particular groups. I mean, just like we've been doing with ISIS and with Al-Qaeda and with all the different factions that have been, you know, at war for as long as we can.
Which is closer to the Syria model, right? Right. So I think you're right, Kyle. People do oppose nation building. But the problem is it runs up into the inner contradiction of, can you decapitate a government with airstrikes and then use Diplomacy 2.0 and CIA assets on the ground to train up a militia to then go over and take over the government? That's likely the play.
Yeah.
And that's Syria's play. That's exactly what we did in Syria.
Right.
Provided air support. We did all these things.
I think it's a worst case scenario.
Well, scenario, right? The idea that this guy's going to show up and then just Iranian society is diverse and is large and is geographically diverse and is difficult terrain it is going to just be like, oh yeah, this guy definitely we will be greeted as liberators, rebranded as we're going to spread monarchy to the Middle East rather than democracy. It's the same, but it's just going to be like, oh, well, we tried democracy. That didn't work, but maybe they'll take a king. And then we'll either try to force it on them with troops on the ground and do it Iraq style, or we'll do it Syria style. And then it'll be 10, 12 years of bloody war, a massive refugee crisis. The number one refugee crisis before now was Syria and Libya. And the biggest reason why, and that's what fueled the migrant crisis across Europe. When we look at this, if this happens with the scale and size, Ted Cruz, $92 million people in Iran. That, according to an estimate I read, would increase the refugee crisis by 76%.
Over what it currently is.
Yes.
And how many tens of millions of people have fled into Europe to this point?
Yeah. Many, I don't know. But yeah, but that's Europe's struggling with it. Where are these people going to go?
I mean, yeah, obviously, we've talked about it ad nauseum on this show. I mean, all of the conflict that's occurring around this, the crime, the cultural resentment of the native Brits or Irish or whatever, and like the burning down of immigration centers, and like, I mean, it's only going to exacerbate those problems.
Mm-hmm. So they have to then choose, like, well, no, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to go live in the war zone that Israel created with an aggressive war over a non-threat.
Yeah.
Right. And like that's the position in which you put people who then have to make that decision. You have to give up your society to be lived in by other people who aren't you, and therefore we lose the identity of German or Norwegian or whatever. Or you have to do a very cruel thing, which is keep peaceful people who just want to get out of a war zone in the war zone.
Right.
That's a terrible position to put them in. And it's all by choice. It's all because Israel wants to feel safer, or they want, you know, more regional cooperation. Right. The business wants to be done there. And that's, to me, and I'm not criticizing you personally, Kyle, just like that plan.
That's the game theory.
I'm criticizing the plan. That plan is placing this commercial activity over the lives of these people as if they are just pawns on a chessboard that do not have inherent dignity or any value to be considered in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And if we had just accepted, not gone on the JCPOA in the first place, or done many other decisions along the line, or accepted, or if they, when we proposed to them, hey, just re-enter pretty much the JCPOA and we'll brand it the Trump plan, that was pretty much on the table as of May. If we would have just accepted that offer, then we would be there.
Yeah. Do you think
something I'll just throw out here right now is it is important to keep in mind that the human casualties currently are actually quite low.
Yeah, but a regime change war in a civil war would be quite
high. This current thing.
Yeah, to be clear.
But like a lot of these are going to the worst case scenario right now. We're not there yet.
Well, I'm saying
like
this
these
is
things
the most
could these things don't have to necessarily go to that extent.
Well, yeah, but I need the argument about why it won't go to the arrangements we've seen repeatedly in the last 20 years, right? Which is your model, right? So if your model is Germany, well, then we got to do a Dresden. If your model is Iraq, we got to go do some nation building. If your model is Syria, then we got to do a 12-year civil war and a huge refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in even like here's another case for the at least two more. The Wall Street Journal had an article this morning about where they are interviewing military historians about this question of, can you do a decapitation that changes a regime? It's never been done before. Right. So maybe they're the first ones. Maybe they can. Or we use diplomacy 2.0 and we just do it all by Iranian social media. I don't even know.
It is worth noting right now, too, is the regime is changing regardless very soon. Khamenei is an 86-year-old man with Biden levels of dementia. The dude does not have decision-making capabilities right
dude,
now.
Dude, I've seen some great AI videos of that guy saying some pretty base shit.
Dude, it's so funny. I have a friend, and I know you listen to the podcast, so you know I'm talking about you. He's been just going and finding old Khamenei tweets. Khamenei is a wild boy on Twitter. It is so funny. And he's just posting like, what the fuck are you even talking about? It's so funny. Right. I just keep seeing him in my feed just being like, it's so hilarious. But that is the thing, the guy himself does not really have decision-making capabilities right now. And the IRGC is kind of their own sovereign entity. And they are the ones much more pursuing the Iranian intelligence and security apparatus to the extent that they are. And it's not my belief from everything I've seen right now that like they have the most power and the stranglehold, but they are kind of the minority in this point in time. Like, I think there is a... I'm just going to say this for funny, a mostly peaceful regime change that could happen. I'm saying that in jest, but I think that there is a road here. It's not guaranteed, but I think there's a road that exists here that is much more peaceful than what we've seen in the past. And I think part of that is just because of the players at it right now. Like I think the Ted Cruz's of the world are ridiculous. Like, I think the Mark Levin's of the world are ridiculous. I actually think there's a middle ground here, and that's the middle, and that's the ground that Trump is currently operating in right now. Like people are too often kind of like looking at it and you're just like, oh, Trump's just doing Bush neocon stuff. And I was like, I don't see that. Like, the neocons have decapitated. The neocons are making a lot of noise on Twitter and they're mad at Trump for not doing certain things too. Yeah. Like, they're trying to put pressure on him for certain things. Lindsey Graham was holding up the BBB in committee until the Iran attack happened. Right? Like there's a lot of navigation of domestic policy that's in play right here. Like, I don't think the story that we have right now, the official story, is necessarily the correct story. I think there's a lot of fog of war going on right now, and a lot of people are playing like statecraft at the moment.
So additional note on that about the troops on the ground and why you might need them. I mean, not only has it never been done before, but you might need them for the same reason that when Bibi proposed to Biden, according to reporting that we've reported on, when he proposed to Biden in last October for this strike that we're doing now, it included commandos on the ground. It didn't have troop numbers. We didn't get access to that. But how many? Well, enough to do something. What are they there for? Well, if you can just bomb it from the sky, do you think Israel's so dumb they're like, oh, we'll use them to go throw grenades at nuclear reactors?
Yeah.
You think that means a military invasion of the country, right? So I fail to see. I just want an argument. I want a piece of argument from somebody that is there's a route here to that, because every time we do this, I hear the same argument.
It's Iranian concession.
They said the same thing in Iraq. Iran. That they're going to defer to the Jordanian king and the blah 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 blah. I got that whole argument already. We already had this argument. It was in 2002 and 2003, right? And when we did so, it was this idea that we'll be able to work with the new government that we put in, and then we'll implement democratic reforms because they'll be a puppet state. And then they became a puppet state of Iran. Right. Yeah. And I'm not so convinced that there is any route here that doesn't wind up with Syria or Iraq. Those are our choices.
I don't think it's necessarily a government change. Like, I don't think that's 100% the only option that's on the table. And even in Trump's mind.
Well,
right now.
But to be clear, if the requirement was any of the plans that we've talked about so far, when we're talking about the enrichment question, right? Because at the crux of this, according to Trump and according to everybody, it's can they have a latent nuclear capability or not? Mm-hmm. Trump's plan is that they need to give that up, shut down all the reactors, and then have a regional nuclear consortium that gives them the material so that they can use them in their nuclear reactors.
For civilian energy purposes.
At the 3.67 range.
That would mean becoming a U.S. client state. Will Khamenei or any of these other factions accept that?
And I think the public accept that of a leader?
Maybe. I'm actually think the most likely is the public, right? But these political factions that you're talking about, the four, which of those is saying, oh yeah, we can do that and have the capability to keep the other factions at bay and will not devolve it to regional ethnic strife, which is the most likely outcome? Because like you said, these people have been fighting in tribes forever. So
Iran
like, the
has
we
not
can
been
in,
fighting in tribes forever, though. That is also the other thing.
No, no, they have real ethnic problems that go back hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Iran is the oldest country on earth right now.
Yes,
like,
but
actually the oldest of the current nation state aspect. Like Iran is the oldest. Yeah.
Yeah. But once again, like I'm not convinced. It isn't like France that had a unification in a singular language and all these other things. They have multiple languages in Iran. They have multiple ethnic identities in Iran. Persians are the majority, but they are consolidated in particular places in Iran. So will they lose control of the hinterlands to other factions? Probably. And once again, like it's that, you know, ends justify the means sort of calculation that I'm most discomfortable with, because then it's saying everyone on the ground, you really don't matter that much. What really matters is whether or not Saudi joins the global market in the way that we want them to.
It is important to note, because I think a lot of people still have this old school framing. This is something this is a software update I had to make in recent years, is that a lot of people still have the Sunni Shia framing that's going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And ever since MBS's takeover of Saudi Arabia, the Iranian relationship with Saudi Arabia has increased quite a bit. Like it appears to me that those two are willing, are slowly making amends over time right now.
Is that right?
Yes.
I'm not sure that's right. Here's why. Are you familiar with the reporting on Soleimani from Grayzone and antiwar.com?
I might be.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the theory is this, and it's interesting because this actually sits behind a lot of our dialogue about this. So one of the things the neocons are using, did you know, and BB said this, do you know that they tried to assassinate Trump? Iran did, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like three people in jail or whatever that we don't have any public info on.
And it could be a real assassination attempt. It could be an FBI sting operation.
One guy's a Pakistani, and then there's like two New York guys. I looked into it.
Yeah.
But there's no available public information on
exactly.
It. We just have
that's what makes me skeptical that it
Iranian
isn't,
ties.
That the two New York guys weren't FBI informants. And I'm not saying that out of nowhere. I'm saying that because I observe a trend and I'm just guessing.
Okay, there's fog of war and we don't know. Like right. That's the thing, is we as the public actually don't know. And we have to just kind of trust Ted Cruz at his word.
Exactly.
We know there's three people in federal prison right now for a Trump assassination attempt.
Which wasn't actually not attempts. Attempted. It was actually a Trump assassination plan.
Plan, yes.
Speech.
That's actually a good correction for me. Yeah. It was a plan.
And that's the sense in which Ted Cruz is right, is they were inept. They were probably inept. Because it was never meant to actually succeed, because it was probably entrapment. But anyways, that's my guess.
And these are pre him getting elected, too.
The argument from Aaron Maté and the folks who've reported on this, using Iraqi and Saudi resources, was the story was, is, let me ask you this, and this is an interesting moment, because I was unaware of this. Why was Soleimani in Iraq?
I don't know. Why was he?
I remember reading at the time, it was to organize Shiite militias against us. Did you know there's an alternative explanation?
I did not.
He was invited there by the Saudi government in order to start negotiating a difference in relations.
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
As a pretext to set up his assassination.
Okay, explain that.
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
So, okay, so here's the story. Saudi reaches out to Iran and says, hey, we should be friends.
I thought that was the official story.
No.
Is that not the official story?
No, not for the murder of Soleimani by drone strike. Yeah. Saudi reaches out. If you ask the average American person, why didn't Trump murder Soleimani? He says, because bad guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what Iranians think. Iranians think he was baited into a trap. And this is based upon the reporting and from what I found in the United States, that he was baited into a trap on diplomatic negotiations, right?
So he was invited to Iran.
To Iraq.
Oh, to
right?
Iraq.
To go from Iran to Iraq, meet Saudi there. They were going to the meeting and he was bombed by the United States.
Drum
so that's how
highway.
We knew he was there and where he was amongst every other piece of intel that we would have, and then took that opportunity to strike him. They, in response, say, we're going to assassinate anyone who gave the orders. This is not only is it, you know, against the UN charter and many different international laws. Of course, their response is like, you invited us to a peace talk and then killed us.
Yeah.
Like our guy.
And when they say you invited us, who?
America.
So the U.S.
Right.
invited.
We take ultimate blame for it because Saudi Arabia, we have troops in Saudi Arabia. We've had them since the 30s.
And Soleimani was also involved with
in across,
hiding bin Laden in Iran. And
yeah,
stuff like
and
that.
Across the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is seen as a proxy state of America.
Sure. So let me just make sure I understand this. Saudi invites Soleimani from Iran to Iraq for a peace talk. Mm-hmm. The U.S. assassinates Soleimani mm-hmm. on his way to mm-hmm. the peace talk.
I think it was on his way out.
It might have been afterwards. I might have misremembered that.
Either way, he's killed by the U.S., I'm assuming with like intelligence and cooperation from Saudi because they're an ally mm-hmm. of the U.S. And the point being to kill him. Why? Because he was there to try to mend relationships between Saudi Arabia and Iran
in order to weaken Iran.
My understanding is that it goes back to bin Laden. That he has ties to bin Laden in the 9/11 attack, and also aiding and abetting bin Laden in the aftermath of it. My understanding is that's some of the justification that was used for it. Now, whether or not that's the correct justification,
right.
I don't know. There was actually one of the 9/11 guys on Tucker Carlson recently was talking, like one of the, like an old senator, I forget his name.
Yeah.
He was talking about this at one point. He's like become a big 9/11 truther. Mm-hmm. But he was talking about that. But yeah, I don't know. It's, another interesting thing too is actually something that
it doesn't make any sense. Saudi Al Qaeda in Iran, we cooperated with Iran against Al Qaeda in both Afghanistan and against the Taliban and against ISIS when they broke from when Al Qaeda became ISIS. I don't understand that at all. Soleimani cooperating with them. That'd be like saying that's like in the same sense that we.
Bin Laden was hiding out in Iran.
No, he's hiding out in Pakistan.
He went hidden in Iran for a while. He was in Tehran for a bit.
In the 1990s?
No, post 9/11.
No,
he went there for a while. Yeah.
No, I've never heard of that before. Yeah.
Obviously,
that's my understanding of what the that's like some of the American intelligence. Now, some of that could be propaganda, but that's my understanding of some of the official story on the intelligence side of it.
Yeah,
is that he was in Tehran for a while.
I don't know about that. Hey, I'm open to it being true. I
don't fact check me on that.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to
fact check me in the comments.
I'm not trying to fact check. I'm just trying to contend with it because I'm like, oh, okay, so I know this and I know this and I know this and I I'm very confident about our cooperation with Iran against Al Qaeda because they're a Sunni group that has for a very long time had been at war with the Shiites on the question of American cooperation and then religious.
It's also important to remember that there are different factions involved in all
this. Yeah, well, they're Shiites in Afghanistan.
That's the thing that I always try to stress is like, oftentimes it's like when you're looking at like Saudi versus Iran, it's much more like this particular faction that has a lot of sway in Iran versus this particular faction that like it's often much more, you have to like look into the sub factions of some of these people and what they're going like just because somebody's part of the IRGC doesn't mean that they're all like one monolithic body.
Well,
like
sure.
They all have different opinions. And we see that with the negotiations, right? Like mm-hmm. where Ali Shamkhani was like a guy that wanted to take Trump's deal. But then the other two guys that were major parts of the negotiations didn't want to take the deal. Mm. And so like you see, and this is a frustrating area of the reporting that I see is that they're like Ali Shamkhani on the negotiating team. He wants to take part of the deal. And Trump was like, it's like, that's not what happened. It's like, there was one guy who's known for the diplomatic approach, who is known for enhancing relations with America and with Saudi Arabia, and also cross-faction support within Iran. He wanted to take the diplomatic approach and was willing to give up the nuclear ambitions of Iran. But the other people of the IRGC did not want to do that. So like people are looking at it as like this one guy, that means Iran wanted to do it. And then Trump just rejected it. It's like, that's not what happened, right? Like the factions matter in all of these.
I mean, I think a key takeaway for me, and I'm curious what your guys' thoughts on key takeaways from this moment in this conflict are, is that the resolution that we get is so much lower than what we actually need to have a full grasp of what is even going on. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's been the case for all of the conflicts in the Middle East. And as we get talking about factional disagreements and conflicts over time, my head starts spinning because it's like, mm-hmm. none of it makes sense to me. I don't understand a lot of the different dynamics in play. And it's almost just like, I could see why people would get overwhelmed by this and just kind of back away from it and just say like, yeah, whatever. Just take them out. I guess if it's going to, make Israel safer, it's going to make the Middle East safer for business. Yeah, great. Just do it. Like,
or do the other instinct, which is just leave. Just let's get out of this. I don't want to be supporting anyone in this, which is a totally reasonable thing.
And that's ultimately my take.
This is the thing. I don't think we can just get out yet. Like, I think that getting out is a process. And I think that we are watching the process take place right now. I think that this is part of the getting out process.
Yeah, I think it's 12 more years of civil war in Iran and a massive refugee crisis and trillions of dollars spent. I think that's much more likely.
Do you? And I guess maybe I'm
just reacting to the moment. And there's things I'm not aware of, but it just doesn't make sense to me how you do this with just drone strikes.
Well, I think you have a very solid track record of events and maybe a little bit of foreign policy PTSD to say that this is how the past ones have gone and this is how I expect the future ones to go, unless something dramatically changes here, which it doesn't seem like it will.
It's incredibly important to note that Iran has not attacked America yet. I think that is a very important point in this, because right now, the way that I see it right now is Trump has kind of laid out his side. Europe has laid out their side. Putin's laid out his side. And now the ball is in Iran's court to make a decision. Now, the IRGC is probably screaming and panicking with like chickens with their head cut off right now. And there is a lot of internal strife that's going on. And there's probably people in there that want to strike a United States military base in retaliation for this because of the intelligence aiding of Israel. I think that there's a lot of that going on, but I'll reiterate what I said before. It's very clear to me that a lot of the people, a lot of the leaders in the Gulf state and Putin himself, and also Trump in his rhetoric, is that they are trying to make it abundantly clear to Iran right now that America is not the enemy. Wait this out right now and come to the table and you can be part of the peacemaking process that fixes the Middle East and stitches this thing back together in the long run. Like, you can continue to play the victim. You should continue to play the victim. Like, but you just have to endure in this moment. Continue to endure. That's like the game as I'm watching the players play out right now.
I think Iran has not attacked America because it would mean a casus belli for America to now get officially involved in the war.
Well, and like, I think it would force America to get involved in the war.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just like, because like, if they attack, Trump will have no other option than to go in.
Yeah.
And I don't think Trump wants to do that. And that's why I think he's being extremely crystal clear. But he has to have this rhetoric with Israel as well. Like I think that there's like these are entangling alliances. We're all entangling it. Like I'm said, we're all entangled in the shit sandwich right now. And I think that we have people that are trying to navigate out of it. And we have people that are trying to navigate into it.
But if he wanted to get out of it, all he had to do is say, no, Bibi, you can't attack Iran. Sorry.
Do you think
we're going to sign a deal?
Do you think it's
like all he had to do was sign the deal?
He let him off the leash, but I think the attack was happening regardless.
Boy, but then you say we're not going to provide IDU support. You say we're not going to shoot down your missiles. I'm going to remove the
who's fueling the jets.
Then Europe handles it. Fine, have at it. You know, and then you're like, well, but then Europe will get access to all this oil. Why do I care? I do not care if Europe gets more Middle Eastern resources out of this.
No, like I think the game. I think the game is that Europe is trying to keep Russia and the United States in. I think that's their game, is that they're trying to continue to starve out those two entities and trying to like they're doing the playbook of of what Al Qaeda did with Russia and America. Like they're kind of helping orchestrate this with their factional power base in their intelligence apparatus within the Middle East. Like the Likud party is more so in my estimation. The more I learn. Is like I bought into the propaganda a lot of ways where I think that a lot of the Israeli propaganda in America of like them being entirely controlled by America or vice versa that is being pushed, I think that it's becoming overblown. Like I think it's real, but it's becoming overblown right now, and I think a lot of that is actually a psyop in order to continue to split the split Trump's base. Like there became a point where after 10/7, it became this thing where it's like now you're becoming more and more allowed to like hate Israel, and I think that's very interesting to me. Hmm. Where it's like now it's just spread out online. The algorithm picks it up everywhere. All of a sudden, you have all these major figures that are popping up that are trying to cause divisions over this very particular issue. I think because of the Likud ties to the British intelligence apparatus, I think that's the psyop.
So your case, if I'm understanding it right, is that if America pulled out or said, no, Bibi, you can't, we're not going to support you in doing that. We're not going to shoot down the rockets. We're not going to provide you intel. We're not going to do any of those things.
I think Trump's hands were tied and he had to.
But wait. But you just said a second ago that if he did, though, there was a benefit to Europe. I'm open to the fact that Trump's hand might be tied, but help me understand how it would benefit Europe if we pulled out. Right.
And I think I'm saying
the opposite of that.
It would.
Okay. So why is Trump serving Europe's interests?
No, I'm saying that he's in a diplomatic battle with them right now. I don't think you're understanding what I'm saying.
Well, I'm trying to.
Because you're asking questions that don't make sense with what I said. Trump is trying to disentangle himself militarily in the long run.
Okay.
But right now he's in the shit sandwich now. Like, that's the problem.
But no, all he has to do is say, no.
You can't just pull out. That's not how this works.
Why not? I mean, if the aim was to pull out, then you say, we are no longer going to provide support for you unless you make a deal with the Palestinians, use all of his, you know, world famousness and support.
Is the political will there to be able to do that stuff? He still has to deal with the domestic policy back at home. Like I said,
well, now
Lindsey Graham was holding up the bill in committee.
Now he's even less so capable of doing that. Lindsey Graham's not going to hold up the tax cuts and Jobs Act extension. That's political suicide for the Republican Party and Lindsey Graham himself. There's all those cards are on Trump's side for the tax cuts.
I don't think Trump has cards, but he doesn't have all the cards right now. So he's navigating just like all of these different players are navigating, and everybody's making different moves. Like, it's not as simple as like, well, just do this. Like, nobody in this framework can just do this.
Wait a minute. So they are just doing this now by doing a war with Iran, right? They're doing a thing. This is a choice, a political choice he's making to appease a base in America. Like, I think those motives are very clear. But that's not pull out. That's commit us for another 10 years in a Syrian war.
Doesn't necessarily mean commit us for another 10 years.
If, don't get me wrong, he could be buying the propaganda that they can just install a king and then it'll be over.
I think there's a lot of assumptions being made to continue to invest
and get more client states rather than, I don't care about this question, I'm going to redesign the Middle East by more engagement, and that requires military engagement of Iran. Right? So, like, if you wanted to pull out, Iran wouldn't even be a problem.
I think there's a lot of assumptions being made here.
Help me. Yeah.
Well, because like you're constantly going directly to like the worst case scenario and everything. And there's a lot of things that, like, from A to Z, there's a lot of B, C, D, E, F.
I already kind of related that out why I think that's true. My point being that he's making choices now. He could have made, if that was just truly his motivation, why didn't he make these other choices is my question, right? Because, like, there's a whole arrangement of choices that he could have just re-gotten to the JCPOA with a deal that they already had on the table and then rejected and then went to war over, right? I mean, if that was the arrangement, but they want a client state. They can't not have a client state in Iran. That's the only way to get the Saudis into the Abraham Accords, and so that they can then ice out the Palestinians.
I think there's a lot of assumptions
there. And the clean break is complete.
I think there's a lot of assumptions there that may or may not be accurate.
Well,
that's the thing is, like, I think that people are leaping too much to conclusions right now.
What conclusion am I leaping to, though?
Like, you're automatically leaping directly to boots on the ground are necessary for regime change. Regime change is necessary, and the end goal is directly United States client state. And it's I think a lot of that is like half true, doesn't necessarily have to be the case and stuff like that. But there's a lot of and justifiably so on the libertarian point of like that there is a track record of how things have been over the last 30 years. So like there's a lot of like, well, we're just looking at that and we're going to reflect our reality. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the framework that we're existing.
Well, I mean, a couple of things here. So
and one, a lot of things are different.
One, we're all guessing at what the real motive is. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I know what it is or I know what's going to happen. I'm just saying if there's a case, the only case I see being built is to put in a crown prince. That's
there is reporting on Prince Reza that Trump has little interest in Prince Reza. There has been reporting.
Right, but that could be disinformation too. He lied to everyone and said he was interested in peace when he put together a plan that could never be accepted.
But this is partly my point here.
And my whole point about being in client state as an inevitable end of that is because that's why the enrichment is the problem, right? That's why enrichment's the case, not weapon. If it was, as soon as you put it on enrichment, the only thing you could do is overthrow that government or get them to become a client state. Those are the only options that I can see. I don't see how else you do that.
I'll close out with one final thought. It goes into what I was trying to say with the Prince Reza thing is if you're listening to like any reporting or even your favorite influencer, nobody knows what the hell is going on. Some people are trying to think strategically and just look at the game board as they're seeing it in the moment. A lot of people are going to have blind spots. I have my own blind spots here, but I think a lot of people are becoming overly, they're like overly emotional and they're kind of jumping in, and there's a lot of people really trying to get clicks right now, and a lot of people are stuck in certain frameworks that may or may not be true, maybe half true. And I think that just be wary with any information you're getting, because everything is propaganda right now. Good and bad propaganda. Propaganda can be used for all ends.
Yes.
Like, propaganda is the way the world works. Everybody's cartels, right? Like, mm-hmm. like that is kind of the my general thesis of the world and how I operate. And but most of these people are playing Machiavellian power games. Most of these people are operating in statecraft. There's a lot of like shadow orchestrations of events that are happening behind the scenes that we don't see in the public.
Right.
So like, there's a lot of that we have to be wary of. Absolutely. And like, there is a lot of media push for Prince Razor right now. There's also evidence that suggests that that's not within Trump's purview of what he wants to do with an installation. Who knows? Like, it's one of those things that's like, literally, who knows right now. Right?
One thing you can be sure of as listeners of Human Reaction is that we're going to do our best to break it down as honestly and thoroughly as we possibly can. Look at all the angles and have some great debates in the process. Mm-hmm. Fellas, thank you so much for your insight and your passion. For David Rand, for Kyle Mack, for Bennett, I'm Joe Sheehan. This is Human Reaction. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember...
Hi, my name is David, and I'm apparently the King of Israel.